Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Where To Go. I'm James Atkinson, Senior Brand Manager at DK Eyewitness.
And I'm Lucy Richards, Senior Editor at DK Eyewitness.
And welcome to Where To Go, where every fortnight we find out more about the world's favourite travel destinations with those people who know those places best. But this week, we have one of our special episodes. So one of our, like, we sort of call them like kind of travel lives episodes, where we interview someone who's just, you know, it's got more than one destination they can talk about, who can really kind of give us an insight into just the kind of vast sort of experiences that you can have around the world. And I think this person really, really personifies that. So,
totally.
Yeah. So, Lucy, who are we talking to today?
So, in this episode, we're going to be joined by a very special guest indeed, award-winning travel writer Emma Thompson, who's painstakingly, it must be said, whittled down three of her favourite destinations to talk to us about. Specifically, and James, I know you didn't ask me if I've been to any of these places because you know I haven't been, because her three destinations are Greenland, the Marquesas Islands and in Polynesia, and Iran.
So, yes.
And also a really nice geographical spread of places, three very different destinations.
I don't think we've ever quite spanned that much geography in one podcast, have we?
Nick Butter.
Oh, Nick Butter. Yeah. Quite possibly, but quite similar.
Yeah.
In terms of range.
Yes.
But yeah. I'm not particularly shocked that you've never been to either any of these three places.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, as well, like my knowledge of these three places is pretty low. Like, I'd say like Iran's maybe the one that I know best. And yeah, I kind of only really know it from a, like, sadly, like a kind of recent news and politics kind of point of view, and actually would be really, really interested to find out a little bit more. But I think Emma is one of those writers who really kind of gets under the surface of a place, really wants to find out more about local culture and communities. And listeners, I think you're in for a real treat hearing what she's got to say. Just to introduce who Emma actually is.
Yes, here we go. So Emma is an extremely well-seasoned, multi-award-winning travel journalist who has travelled and written for leading publications such as The Times, The Telegraph and National Geographic Traveller, not to mention guidebooks for the likes of Rough Guides and also us here at DK. So, welcome, Emma.
Hello.
Hello. Brilliant to have you on the podcast at long last.
Yes,
so,
exactly.
As it's one of our special episodes today, we're going to be covering three destinations. But first, let's get to know Emma a little better. So, Emma, how did you fall into the world of travel writing?
Well, I was a bit of a nerd from early on, actually. I was travel obsessed since, I think, probably the age of two, three. I remember catching a plane. We're living up in Scotland, catching a plane down to visit my grandmother who lived in London, and looking out the window and having a very clear thought of, I have to see as much of this world as possible. Wow. And it sort of just escalated from there, really. And, you know, I would spend my lunchtimes in the library researching places, and And then when I left school, when I was at uni, we had a student newspaper, and they didn't have a travel section. So I, you know, full of gusto, was like, you need one. So I started off doing that. And I was just a real geek. I got loads of work experience in my uni holidays. And that actually was really useful, because a lot of questions I get asked is about how to break that sort of catch 22 of getting published if you're not published, but no one giving you a chance if you're not.
I
was living in Oxford at the time, and they have the Oxford Times newspaper there, and they had like a one-page travel section with a lovely guy, but I think he'd been doing it for like 60 years. And I said, oh, can I write a piece, you know, while I'm here? And so I self-funded a trip and wrote about that. And that was my first published piece. And that was great. And I just did work experience with Lonely Planet and Wanderlust. And finally, Brat, Travel Guides.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And I was just really lucky. Like, when I finished the placement there, they said, do you fancy a job? And I said, yes, please.
Excellent.
And obviously, Emma, I mean, you've travelled so much as a travel writer. What do you love most about the job? I guess apart from the obvious, what is it about travel writing?
Occasionally, I don't know if this sounds bad or not, but occasionally you do get to nudge the world a little. Like, I really love sort of covering destinations that, you know, recovering from political upheaval or a natural disaster, and occasionally, you know, you do get the chance to cover these stories where, you know, for instance, I was thinking like back to Turkey, you know, in 2017, they were really reeling from like a military coup at the end of 2016. And they'd had quite a few isolated terrorist attacks. And, you know, Turkey is a huge country, but everyone was just avoiding it en masse. And, you know, the Foreign Office, they hadn't updated their advice. And so they lost like half their tourist numbers overnight. And all these local businesses were just reeling, and it went on for years, and maybe like 2 or 3 years. And so I went over and I did a piece there and interviewed locals who had the small businesses and small guest houses and did a piece. And it was really nice, because I got letters back from them afterwards saying that it sort of made a difference and people were coming back and they'd seen bookings increase. And so that's nice to know that sort of, you're just making a small difference. That's the kick I get out of it.
Yeah, that's cool. That's really cool. And you've chosen to talk about three very different places today. So we're going to start off by talking about Greenland. Then we're going to, and you'll have to correct me on my pronunciation here, talk about the Marquesas Islands in Polynesia, and then Iran. We know you had a lot of options. You actually gave us more options than that as well. I think we had quite a difficult job by pulling that down. But how did you go
nice
down?
Geographical round, spread like, these three.
It was, yes.
Yeah, I think that's why we went for them. But we know you had a lot of options. How did you go about choosing them?
Well, Greenland's an interesting one, because I was originally sent there because it was really being built up as the new Iceland. Iceland's sort of, you know, getting a hard rap at the moment of being too crowded, and certain areas are.
Yes.
And everyone's like, oh, Greenland's next door. That's that's the nearest alternative. And it couldn't be more different in many ways. Iceland is incredibly well set up for tourism, and Greenland is, it's just not. Like, there are no roads apart from, you know, the one main town through, sorry, main one main road through town. You have to get everywhere by boat or small aircraft still, and it's, you know, it's covered by this ancient ice cap, which is the size of Spain, and the population, I think it's something around 56,000, which is tiny compared to the massive landmass, are just sort of like leaking out, living on the fringes. But that's the surprising thing about it. People think, oh, it's just the ice cap, but it's actually really verdant in summer, where you've got sort of, you know, like crowberries growing in amongst the plants, and you've got wild mushrooms, and it's great for foraging if people are into foraging. And it just has such an intact culture still, because it is very new to tourism. So it's a great way of seeing sort of Inuit culture, and also, you know, I've noticed this growing trend of people really enjoying silence when they go places, or just really wanting to disconnect.
Yeah.
And
okay.
There's not a huge amount of Wi-Fi, and it is... It has this incredible sense of silence around it. I mean, most of the soundtrack is just like the bergs cracking in the bay, or, you know, occasional like bark of one of the dogs. But it really sinks into you and chills you out, and it's lovely.
And how about the Marquesas Islands? How did you go about picking those?
So it is so remote, this group of islands. It's about 12 islands. Only 6 of them are inhabited. But a lot of famous people have visited them. So you can come to that later if you want. But it's...
Yes.
There's lovely history of writers and artists visiting them. So I was quite intrigued.
And then finally, we were talking about Iran, which I think I was actually a little bit late to join this recording, because I was in a world reading about Iran. So I'm really looking forward to hearing you talk about Iran, Emma, I must say.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of the most misjudged places I've been. Yeah. You know, a lot of people, you know, are still have their opinions informed by, you know, news reports or, you know, the FCO warnings and things like that. And it's very different on the ground. Yes, it still has its troubles, but it's... a completely different world on the ground.
Great.
3 fantastic destinations. Let's find out a lot more about them. So when did you first visit Greenland?
So I went twice. The first time was in 2018. And as I say, it was sort of this idea that it could be the new Iceland, but there were also... really starting to look towards tourism, because they have 2 problems. One is, as you know, it's owned by Denmark, but they rely hugely on subsidies. I think it's something like $591 million a year that they get sort of bailed out each year, which as a source of pride for them is not great. But also mining companies are sort of really sort of knocking on the door to get, there's huge deposits of like uranium and iron and things. And obviously that is not a sustainable form of income. It might be, you know, short wealth for them, but they really want to try and do things more sustainably, which is why they're looking into the tourism. And the second time was I was sailing down the coast of Greenland and then across to northern Canada. So I spent some time there again as well. Both times were fantastic.
Really cool.
Very cool. I mean, when I think of, you sort of touched on this, Emma, but when I think of Greenland, I mean, it's just, as you said, like a huge expanse of ice, and then it's that kind of southwest corner that feels that's where
that's where most of the action is happening. And I say action as a loose term, but
what sorts of activities can you actually do in Greenland?
So they are sort of upping their game, and they will offer, you know, in winter like snowmobiling tours or dog sledding, obviously whale watching, incredible up there. It's amazing for hiking in summer. There's the Arctic Circle Trail, which I think is like 160 kilometers, where you can camp along it. Beautiful.
Amazing.
But for me, as I said, the appeal is just to get this sense of real sort of frontier life. I mean, a lot of the communities, these are not homes that have sort of, you know, the picket fence around them, and you're more likely to have like, you know, antlers hanging up than the washing line sort of thing. And and everyone has like working dogs. And so it was just these opportunities to see, you know, everyday activities that you just wouldn't, like, you know, the guys would come in and they would have, you know, be flensing a seal, like skinning the seal on the dock, which can be quite confronting for some people. But again, this is, you know, part of their culture. They use every part of the animal. There's no waste. They don't over hunt them. Mm-hmm. You know, just seeing, like, you'd see the drying racks out the front of the homes with whale biltong drying. And just... they've got a wonderful, like, protected costume as well. There's one thing I'd say is like a really good start to understand Greenland is there was a guy called, forgive my pronunciation now, Knud Ramason. So he was half Danish and half Greenlandic, but he grew up there from when he was a child. And he sort of became sort of the father of Inuitology, and because he spoke the language, he knew how to work the dogs. And he noted down a lot of their, oral histories. And there's a really great museum in Ilulissat, which is about an hour flight north of the capital Nuuk. And it's such a good place to start to really sort of get under the skin of the place a bit. Incredible sort of hand drawing etchings that he'd done and carvings. And yeah, it's really good.
Great.
Cool. So you mentioned a little bit about kind of the whale biltong and the skinning of the seal, etc. Did you actually sample any of the local food when you were there?
So they have, again, pronunciation, but it's called kiniak, which are the ox sea birds, which have been fermented inside seal skin, which is meant to be a delicacy. I haven't tried it. apparently, it's more of a winter thing, and I was visiting during summer. So, but maybe I got off lightly there because apparently the smell is atrocious.
Yeah, I was going to say I'm not entirely sure how appetizing that sounds to me, but there's always next time.
Yeah, but they have things like muskox and obviously a lot of fish like halibut, and they smoke it, which it tastes great. Mm. It tastes great. And in fact, there's if you want a restaurant recommendation, there's a fantastic one that's part of a lodge. It's called Ilmenak Lodge, and it's not far from Ilulissat, and fantastic, fantastic food. They sort of really reimagine the sort of Greenlandic cuisine to sort of elevate it.
It's always good to have recommends, definitely for restaurants as well.
And in terms of, like you mentioned about the kind of lack of infrastructure as well in Greenland, have you kind of seen, is it starting to build up a little bit? Is it more accessible to go?
Not really. I mean, because of the harshness of the conditions there, just to keep the roads clear is a huge amount of work. So that's why I say it's so sparse still. So yeah, everyone just uses boats or planes to get around still, or on foot. I mean, you can you can hike to your extent, but no, it's still in its infancy. And Ilmenak Lodge, as I mentioned, that's sort of part of a new generation where they're trying to do this sustainable tourism model. In most towns you'll visit, there's maybe like one or two places to stay, maybe one restaurant. Most people just grab supplies from the supermarket and do their own thing. It's, as I say, it's great frontier living, and it feels very adventurous. It's lovely.
Yeah, it sounds adventurous. Yeah. Very cool.
Very cool.
Very, very cool. I imagine.
Freezing in winter.
Yeah.
To be cool.
just a little bit cool. Okay, cool. Well, we've heard about Greenland. Now on to the Marquises.
So Emma, the Marquesas Islands, which are in Polynesia, what did you make of them? I mean, they're incredibly remote and paradise-like. Mm. What did you make of them when you, arrived?
Well, it's funny. So I'm going to quote two writers now, because... So Paul Theroux, he visited in 1991 when he was writing The Happy Isles of Oceania, and he said... They were the most beautiful islands on earth. And I love this, the tableau on which travellers can paint their fantasies. So that gives you a sort of an idea of their beauty. I mean, it's these jagged jungle clad mountains tumbling down into just pristine, the pristine Pacific. Whereas Robert Louis Stevenson, when he visited in, I think it was 1888, he said, oh, they're just like the Scottish Highlands. So, not everyone's cup of tea, but no pleasing some.
It's quite a long way to go just to see the Scottish Highlands,
exactly.
Right? What did you think? Which side are you, Paula? Are you Robert?
Again, I'm just drawn to these sort of, raw places that are sort of really off the beaten track. And it is entirely that. It's... Again, they have a very intact local culture that's highly steeped in sort of mysticism and shares, these links with Easter Island and the rest of the Polynesian sort of islands. And it's just a place, and this sounds a bit cliche, that you need to experience and just be in. There's not, it's not a sense that there is this big bucket list of things to see and do to tick off. It's just this vibe. It's this, there's a sense of communion with nature that isn't cliched. It's entirely their way of life that really sort of connects you to something deeper, if that doesn't sound too cheesy. No, and it does stay with you.
And wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit more about the people who live on the islands?
So they, I think they were, I might be wrong here, but I think they were one of the last Polynesian archipelagos to be colonized, just because of the sheer distance. Like everyone would be, you know, in the outrigger canoes sort of paddling. And it's, to give you a sense, I mean, you can fly there from Tahiti now, but I took a cargo boat, and I think it takes 3 days of nonstop sailing just to get there from Tahiti. So it gives you a sense of their isolation.
Oh, wow.
And they, you know, like most sort of communities in that area, they really were put through the ringer. I mean, they had, you know, the Spanish, I think, turned up in sort of the 1500s, as they were like to do. And, you know, when they arrived, the communities were still practicing cannibalism. Everyone was covered in tattoos. Of course, you know, they freaked out, shot a whole load of them. And that was, you know, the community's first sort of encounter with Europeans. And then they were sort of left alone for a couple hundred years. Catholic missionaries turned up, again, freaked out. You know, they were far too naked, enjoying sex far too much, and sort of stamped all that out and banned the practicing of tattooing, which is incredibly like a cornerstone of their culture. It's I can go into a little bit if you like. It's wonderful.
Yeah, so, go for it. Yeah, yeah.
So essentially, the tattoo artist in the communities, they act almost in a sort of shaman-like way, where if a man has lived a, you know, first of all, the job is passed down within those families. It's not like anyone can become like a tattoo artist there. And if a man has lived a good life, he should be entirely covered with tattoos by the time he dies. So every sort of event of his life is marked with a set of symbols. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you would go to, and this is still practiced now, you would go to one of these men and you tell him your life story, and then he chooses the symbols where they should go and marks them on your body. And I actually had a funny story. So I was interviewing quite a few of the guys out there about it, and one of them I became quite friendly with, and he said, you know, would you like one, because women have it too. And I was like, okay. And it was only when I was sort of on the lying down where I suddenly thought, wait a minute, I have like no say over the size, shape, form, this thing that's going to be on my body forever. But luckily it turned out really nicely.
Oh, good. Oh, so you did get one.
Yeah. It was, it's on the side of my body, but it was quite painful when he hit the ribs. I had to do some serious meditating, but,
Yeah.
Is it kind of like a sort of stick and poke style thing?
Yeah.
Or,
they use pig bone and then, hammer away.
And did you, so did you tell him some of your life story and then he chose, oh, that's amazing, Emma, what an experience.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was.
What did he depict? Or?
So it's hard to describe, but essentially, so there's a hibiscus flower in the centre, which is, you know, a very common flower on the islands. And then spanning out from that is a sort of series of symbols that sort of flow northwards and southwards. And that the hibiscus flower depicts the division between land and sea. And so the bottom symbols are associated with sea and safe travel, because obviously I came there by boat. And then the top one, he actually gave me one of their ancient symbols, which is two, actually. One is symbolizes mana, which is like the energy that sort of the life force of the islands, essentially. And and the second is a tiki figure. And the tikis are very similar to the moai on Easter Island.
Okay.
Yeah. And they symbolize their ancestors. So it's a sort of nice token of, like, our ancestors go with you sort of thing. So.
Oh, it's amazing. That sounds incredible. What an experience.
Yeah, I was very lucky.
And what a lot to fit into the one tattoo as well.
Yeah.
You're going to get one tattoo. There you go. That's go to Marquises. Do you have any... So if someone did want to visit Marquises, you've said about, you know, you can fly from Tahiti now, but are there any like sort of specific travel trips, tips for getting there or experiencing
it? I mean,
it?
Like I said, you can fly, but there is this boat, the Aranui 5, which I would far recommend sailing with if you can. Because as I said, it's a working cargo ship, so it takes, you know, like cement, mm-hmm. cars, sugar to the islands. And then it's yep. got places for passengers as well. I mean, it's not like that rough and ready, don't worry. There's still like a dining room and things like that and nice nice rooms. And you just really get that sense of arriving in a place slowly. And it also, you know, it stops off at most of the main islands as well. So that's a really good way of seeing them. There's a couple of, you know, ceremonial complex sites which are worth seeing, sort of on Niku Hiva, which is which you'll stop at. Niku Hiva is probably, I'd say, probably the quietest capital you're ever going to encounter in your life. I mean, there's literally like a bank, one shop, and a church. but then the other island, which is Hiva'oa, is obviously famous. I made reference to it being visited by some famous people in the past. So
yes,
as well as like Paul Theroux and Robert Louis Stevenson, you had Herman Melville, who wrote Moby Dick. He jumped ship there in the 1840s because he didn't enjoy his whaling job. And he ended up writing, which if you want some background reading, a book called Teepee, which is it's a novel. Mm. And then Paul Gauguin and Jacques Brel are both buried there. So Jacques Brel, you know, the famous Belgian singer, it was in the latter years of his life. He was sadly dying from lung cancer. And but the locals loved him. Like, he would use his plane to like drop mail off between the islands and take the kids to school between islands. Gauguin, not so much. He had got several underage girls pregnant, spread syphilis. Was drunk most of the time on absinthe. They didn't love him so much. I mean, there is still like a small museum to him because obviously, you know, his painting was incredible. But so they're buried, both buried in the Cimetière du Calvaire, which is on Hiva'oa. So you can't miss seeing those.
All right. Well, that's a great introduction to the Marquesas. And yeah, onwards to quite a different country now. We're going to talk about Iran. If you've been inspired by this episode and want to start planning your next adventure, then DKR Witness will have a book for you. Explore hundreds of destinations in our newly updated DKR Witness or Top 10 Guides, get insider tips on the world's biggest cities with our new Like a Local series, or get bucket list planning with our inspirational books, including The New Gods of the World and Hike. Find all those and so much more via the link in our episode bio or by visiting your local bookshop.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So, Ebba, can you quickly just remind us a little bit about why you chose to talk about Iran?
I think because it is just such a misunderstood country where so many of our opinions are formed by the news reports and, you know, Foreign Office warnings. And I just wanted to see what the reality was on the ground. And I was just very lucky that National Geographic were open to commissioning me. And so I went for them. And because I think, do you remember when that film Argo came out about the hostage situation in the 70s? I think, you know, a lot of people's opinions have sort of stopped around that period because that also marked the transition from sort of the Persian monarchy to the reign of the Ayatollahs. And obviously there was a huge shift in culture then. But it, you know, we forget that its history extends so much further back than that. And there is actually some really surprising elements to it. You know, this is, you know, also the birthplace of Zoroastrianism, which is like one of the world's oldest monotheistic religions. And it's, they have a place linked to Zoroastrianism, which are the Towers of Silence. So Zoroastrians, they believe that if you, you know, burnt a corpse, it would pollute the air, or if you buried it, it would pollute the earth. And so what they do is they would lay the corpses in circles on these Towers of Silence, where, sorry, it's not very nice, but they would essentially be picked clean by the birds, but that was considered a clean death. And these, you know, this is a practice that's 3,000 years old, and some of these towers still exist on the outskirts of Yazd, which is one of the main towns. So you can visit places like that. You've obviously got the UNESCO site of Persepolis, which was founded by Darius the Great. And one of the great facts I love about this, you know, Iran's obviously given, you know, criticized heavily for its politics. But this was a place where Darius the Great hosted essentially what was the first United Nations. So he invited ambassadors from all across the empire to gather and have like the first democratic discussions. So there'd be like the Nabataeans and the Babylonians, and you know, that's something that it gets lost a bit.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, it's
The recent history kind of like overshadows that kind of
And it was also, you know, on the main artery of the Silk Road. So you've got this huge, incredible history of trade, you know, the silks and the spices and the ivory and the porcelain. And what people also don't know is, you know, you're not just staying in, you know, clinical hotels. You have these caravanserai, which during the Silk Road heydays, they would be posted every 20 miles. And it was 20 miles because that was the length a camel could walk in a day. and, you know, there used to be like over 1,000 in Iran. And there is one that's been sort of restored, and you can stay there, and you're sleeping on a mattress in the stables or the former stables. But it's just incredible, that sort of, you know, preserved sense of history. So it's these elements you wouldn't expect,
And like kind of like connecting with like those journeys that so many people have taken in the past as well, I guess, and like kind of seeing it a bit through their eyes.
Exactly.
Iran is absolutely huge. I don't think I appreciated how big it is. Do you have any sort of favourite places in Iran or anywhere that you would recommend listeners go if they, you know, if they are heading that way?
So one place that is well visited now, but is unmissable, is Isfahan, because it was a centre. I mean, the main square that it centres around, Nashijan Square, is the largest in the world, I believe. And it once served as the polo field, where there was a palace on one flank of the rectangle, and it was this incredible, massive polo field. I think they might have played with human heads at one point, but don't quote me on that. But it has this incredibly rich artistic community where you have Mina Karai, which is sort of copper work that's been hand painted in sort of beautiful aqua blue and white colours. It's incredibly detailed. And you have miniaturists, which are men that can paint portraits that are no bigger than your thumb, but they paint them with a single... like the single hair of a paintbrush. You have to hold a magnifying glass up and you can see the individual hairs on a man's beard, and it's incredible work. So it's just wonderful, you know, wandering around there. And then the other really incredible place is Shiraz, because, you know, that's where Hafez and Saadi, the Persian poets, were born. So it's a very romantic city. It's like they call it the city of like roses and wine and nightingales. And you also have, I mean, it's been quite Instagram to death now, but there is, it's the Pink Mosque, or Nazir ul Murk Mosque. And if you visit in the morning, its windows are these incredible sort of fractured stained glass patterns, and in the morning the sunlight shines through them to create these kaleidoscopic patterns on the floor of the mosque. And it's quite a spiritual experience, and so that's very popular to visit. So if you're going the first time, I definitely recommend those places.
Very, very cool. And you sort of have talked about this a little bit already, but like obviously, there's lots of preconceptions about what Iran is today, but are there any other kind of like preconceptions or myths you'd like to bust about Iran?
So one thing I would say is that the division between the old and the new generations is becoming more and more marked. I mean, I'm sure you've heard stories of the younger generation. They'll sort of host house parties and they'll sort of, you know, walk through the streets sort of covered. And then, you know, they get inside and they throw off and they're, you know, head to toe in Gucci, and it's a very stylish place. And I was reminded that over and over again. I visited the country twice now, and they are very keen to make it clear to visitors that, you know, not all that you hear is the truth. And that they are very progressive. A lot of the women, you know, are, you know, in full-time university education, doing engineering degrees, all that. And I think one of my favourite memories actually was I was outside a restaurant, and an old lady was sat on a bench, and we got to talking, and she had like two teeth or something in her mouth. Like, she was very, very old. And she said, she, you know, took my hand and sort of squeezed it. And she's like, oh, guests are, you know, so dear to us. And she said, you know, we're not like Saudi Arabia. And she sort of drew up her black veil to sort of signal the wearing of the burqa.
Yeah.
And she said, we're not like that. And she said, anyway, it's your queen who's not free. She said, she's always having to wear those same outfits all the time. And I was like, fair enough.
Yeah. Good point.
And
I mean, I was thinking with the Jubilee stuff the other weekend, like how all the kids have to wear those little sailor uniforms and stuff. No kid wants to do
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
That's a good point.
So, and I just love the way she sort of flipped the script on me, and I was like, yeah. And that's definitely what you'll get if you go to Iran. It's, you know, it's always hitting the headlines occasionally, but most of the times it's stable enough to visit, so...
Yeah, yeah. Did you visit Tehran as well when you were there?
Briefly. I mean, it sounds awful, I tend to avoid capitals because they're sort of a microcosm of their own. They're not hugely representative. I mean, Tehran is like very progressive. I mean, a lot of the women will just sort of have their headscarf dangling off the back of the bun of their head or something. Whereas as you go further out, it's perhaps more adhered to or whatever. But so I prefer to visit the sort of more out of the way towns. I find they're more representative of, you know, the general sense of a place.
Yeah, the real kind of culture and stuff. Well, you've given us a really interesting window into Iran there. And yeah, hopefully inspire a couple of visits as well.
Yeah, we'll have to go.
And also, can I just say, it's just so wonderful at last, Emma, to have you on the podcast.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Fabulous. Just could listen to you all day, honestly. Thank you so much.
As we say, listener, Emma did give us a long, long list as well. We kind of picked out three very, very different examples you gave us. But I feel like you could talk about so many different countries.
What were your other suggestions, Emma?
I think I recommended Sudan and...
Sudan, that was it.
There's St. Helena as well.
That's a quirky one.
Yeah, that is really, really quirky. But thank you so much for talking us through those three examples. And so wonderful to have you on the podcast. And I'm sure we shall catch up with you very soon.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Genuinely, that was so fascinating. Emma has just... Emma genuinely is a prolific traveller and writer. And as we said, you know, she's won various awards and is hugely respected in the industry. But you can tell why she's so spectacular, just how she managed to set the scene for us and her incredible anecdotes, the tattoo one, I just loved.
Yeah, what an amazing
experience.
What a great tattoo. Like, I feel like I've got a couple of tattoos and people always get really bored of my answers when I just say that they're like things I like or something. But that's like one of the best tattoo stories you can have. And I think it's like a really nice example. We talked about it in the intro, but like, you know, of how Emma kind of like beds into local culture, how she kind of how she tries to get under the skin of what a place is really, really about. That the old lady in Iran, and
I know. I was just thinking, James, I love your description of get under the skin when talking about Emma's tattoo.
Oh yeah, it did sound a bit painful.
Sound painful. But yeah, it was a wonderful, wonderful episode, and Emma was a fabulous guest. So big thank you to her. And if you want to follow Emma on all her incredible adventures and read some of her incredible writing, listeners, you can catch up with her on Instagram at Emma Thompson Travels.
Yes, and I highly recommend reading some of her articles and pieces as well. Like, if you've just got a taster of what Emma's about in this podcast, there's a hell of a lot more out there. So yeah, so in our next episode, it's one of those ones, Lucy, we don't know where we're going. Who knows?
No idea.
You know, we're ahead of schedule here. But, you know, listener, maybe you have got an idea of somewhere where we should go next. If so, let us know at DK Eyewitness. It's all of our social handles. And but until then, it's bye from me.
And it's bye from me.
And we shall see you very soon.
Where to Go was produced by the team at DK Eyewitness and the wonderful Julia Baker. It was presented by James Atkinson and Lucy Richards and mastered by Johnny Coddington at Bottle Rocket Recording. For more information about DK Eyewitness, follow us on social media at DK Eyewitness or visit dk.com/eyewitness.
And don't forget to please like, rate, review and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Your support means so much to us.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.